This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Katie Balls. This week, the new Italian coalition's proposed government was blocked by the Italian president, giving EU grandees in Brussels a cause for celebration. But is the EU way too controlling of rebellious member states? We hear from Douglas Murray and Tom Nuttall, the Economist Charlemagne columnist.
The fact is that somebody who has even played around with these ideas and sometimes posited them is deemed to be unacceptable by the president on behalf of Brussels is, I think, a profoundly serious challenge for people who believe in democracy.
On the home front, would a Eurozone crisis help or hinder Brexit negotiations? I talked to James Forsyth and Nigel Farage.
I think if, you know, this downturn that may come as a result of the Italian crisis leads to an illiquidity crisis in the banking sector, then effectively the City of London is almost the lender of the last resort.
And last, things aren't going much better across the Atlantic with Mueller's investigation on Trump. Or are they? I talked to Lucino Mueller on his progress.
There have been 19 people indicted, 3 companies indicted, 5 plea deals. There's one person in prison already. When we compare this to previous investigations that were frankly less complex and less international than this one, it does show you there is progress being made. And with the plea deals that have come in, it would be surprising to me if there is not more information that is more directly related to the Russian ties than we have seen before.
First, Brussels has got a problem. Across Europe, populist politicians are winning elections on Eurosceptic platforms. Douglas Murray argues in this week's cover piece that even though the public has spoken, Brussels just can't handle democracy when elections don't go their way. That's why, he writes, Italy's populist coalition has prematurely met its end. So is the EU really so controlling? Douglas joins me to discuss, together with Tom Nuttall, the Economist Charlemagne columnist. Douglas, in your cover piece, you write that the EU has revealed its true colours this week.
Well, yes. I mean, it should be said it's not the first time that's been able to be said. I just think that the situation in Italy and the response to the attempted coalition put together in the aftermath of March's Italian election is particularly revealing, because it seems, at the point at which we're speaking, that the Italian people will probably have to go back to the polls, because the Italian president has not approved the appointment of a finance minister who does not carry what one might regard from Brussels as the correct views on a whole range of issues. And for this, I say that, yes, it shows something which anyone who's followed this closely for some years will have picked up by now, but that dissent from the orthodoxy is really not tolerable.
Yes, Tom, this week we've also had, in light of events in Italy, Germany's EU commissioner suggest at one point that the markets were going to teach the Italians not to vote for populist governments. Do you agree with this idea that the EU is a bureaucratic dictatorship?
Probably not a phrase that I would alight on. The first thing to say is that Günther Oettinger, the commissioner in question, this thing got slightly out of hand because his original comments were mistranslated. The thing caught fire. And once the correct quote was distributed, which was certainly problematic, but somewhat less so, the narrative had been unleashed. And it was, of course, capitalised upon by parties in Italy. It was certainly an extremely unwise comment, and it feeds the narrative, especially in some debtor countries inside the Eurozone, that voters need to be given the sort of the firm smack of the financial markets to bring themselves back into line. So it was extremely unwise. I think it's a bit of a leap to move from a comment from a notoriously gaffe-prone European commissioner to the phrase that you use, though.
But Douglas, moving to the EU and the role they do or do not play, I mean, you put the collapse of the five-star league coalition in Italy down to the EU. But in fairness, it was President Mattarella who made the decision to reject the coalition's government. So it was ultimately his doing.
Yes, the president's view was that, among other things, that he was going to be protecting Italian savers in doing so. And that may be the case, it may not be the case. The point is that, first of all, the coalition in question between Five Star and the League was always one of the more implausible coalitions to be put together, even by Italian political coalition standards. And it, by no means, is obvious that it would have lasted for very long. I mean, my own prediction was that Salvini of the League would, for instance, take a position like interior minister, would do a few sort of tough things or seem to be tough, various things would fail, and sometime next year they would go back to elections and the League would benefit from the various stances that Salvini was presenting himself as having taken. As always with predictions in politics, but particularly with predictions in Italian politics, these predictions are stale by the time the words are out of your mouth or the thought has gone through your brain. So all of this is of course unstable. It's built on an unstable idea that Firestar and the League could particularly work together. I mean, just look at the framework agreement that they were working on. But no, the specific thing, of course, it's in the president's gift constitutionally to reject appointments, and indeed, you know, to reject the proposed people for positions, including prime minister. But the fact that the professor who I mentioned the piece, who was being appointed, being proposed as the finance minister, took various historic stances, including the idea that Italy may at some point have to look at. As I understand it, he's not suggesting that it was certainly what Italy should be doing, but he has at times suggested that Italy may at some juncture need to look at floating, for instance, another currency, or looking for a way out of the Eurozone. That is a statement of fact. I mean, if you are concerned with an economy like Italy's, and you look at the range of possibilities it might have to weigh up in order to get through these crises, then that is one. But the fact is that somebody who has even played around with these ideas and sometimes posited them is deemed to be unacceptable by the president on behalf of Brussels is, I think, a profoundly serious challenge for people who believe in democracy.
Tom, in a way, the handling by both the Italian president and the response in Brussels, don't you think this actually plays into the hands of the populist governments by, again, denying the people what they voted for?
Yes, to a degree I do, actually. But the first thing to say, though, is, well, what did people vote for? They didn't vote for this finance minister, this notional finance minister. Nobody had heard of him until his name emerged in the course of trying to put a government together. It's also true that very few people in Italy can be said to have voted to leave the Eurozone. It wasn't part of the platform that either party put to the voters before the election or the joint programme that they assembled together after the election. But your broader point is absolutely right. There is a serious tension, and it's not the first time we've seen it in Italy or elsewhere, between the commitments that governments sign up to when they join the Eurozone and subsequently in various reforms that have been made over the years, and the sovereign right of people to determine the democratic trajectory of their own country. In this particular case, I think you need to be a bit careful. Douglas used the phrase, Mattarella rejected the government on behalf of Brussels. I don't know if he's seen phone records from the Berlaymont to the presidential palace in Rome, but this, as far as I can see, was simply a president exercising a constitutional right that previous Italian presidents have done when they've been unhappy about particular ministers. There's nothing constitutionally or untoward about that. I think, for what it's worth, that the most plausible reading of this particular situation is that it was engineered by Matteo Salvini, the leader of the League, to create a situation where either you have a very unstable government that would probably not last very long, you return to fresh elections in which the League would hope to do well, or you'd have the situation that we're in now, you have a sort of mini constitutional crisis, fresh elections look even more likely, and the League has done very well in the polls recently. And I think Matteo Salvini looks well placed to be the next prime minister. So there are political machinations here that go beyond the particular question of how you marry your obligations as a Eurozone member and the democratic self-determination rights of a sovereign people.
If I may, just two things quickly. One, the proposed coalition government was, of course, not suggesting that it was going to leave the Eurozone. This wasn't a policy. There were some proposals put forward by the coalition government that was going to be formed, but it wasn't that the coalition government of the League and Five Star was actually going to exit the Eurozone. Merely that a finance minister has said that at some point, as I said earlier, that at some point Italy may have to look into what plan B might be required to exit the Eurozone if it came to such a pass. And I mean, I think it's a responsible position to take for any politician, that you've got to find fire exits. And Brussels's view is that you should never locate a fire exit because there will never be a fire. And some people just aren't satisfied with that assurance. The second thing is quickly, as for the phone transactions between Brussels and Rome, no, I haven't seen the phone transactions between Brussels and Rome, but I think it's fairly clear that at least some phone calls have taken place between these two cities in recent days.
And Tom, in a way, obviously we went in on that phone call. I think we can all agree on that. But
I'm sure some people were, by the way.
It will come out in due course. But the replacement prime minister that has been put forward is someone who has suggested there shouldn't be referendums in Europe on issues like this. So it does feed into this idea that it is part of an establishment view to stop the populists.
Mr. Scissors, yeah, not perhaps President Mattarella's finest hour. Well, I mean, we don't have time to get into the question of the appropriate issues to which referendums can be applied. I mean, there's a particular complication in Italy. You can't actually put Euro membership to a referendum, at least not under its current constitutional arrangements. I mean, yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that proposition. I do think that the question of whether referendums can be applied to international obligations is not a straightforward one, and we've seen this in several instances in Europe over the last few years. But, this is a guy who his background is in the IMF. He's earned this nickname through an apparent fondness for budget cutting, for austerity programs over the years. It does look like it's almost as if the script were written by the populists themselves to demonstrate the truth of their own argument. So I don't think it was necessarily a particularly sensible thing to appoint this particular individual. But I think when it comes to referendums, there is a discussion to be had.
If I may just leap in and berate both my fellow discussant and my interviewer for using the term populist in this way. You've both trodden on a great bugbear of mine. Populism has become a word that is being used simply for anybody who votes the wrong way. And I think that this whole definition of this term has become wildly politicized and politicized to a very useless, eventually, degree. Not least because, as I mentioned in passing in the piece, by any ordinary definition, one would describe Mr. Macron in France as being a populist, a one-man political entity who didn't even need a political party. It's only because he has the correct views on Brussels and so on that he is not described as a populist, whereas in numerous countries in Europe the people vote, as it were, for the wrong government, who said the wrong things, and even when they repeatedly send their representatives back with large mandates, they are then derided as populists. And I at any rate really want to resist and urge other people to resist this term, because effectively it's become a term just used for people I disagree with.
I mean, I think there's half a point there. I think Macron...
Three quarters, sure.
Macron was certainly an outsider. This is a subject for another conversation. I'd resist the application of the term populist to him. But I will say that having seen Matteo Salvini speak last year in Germany alongside Marine Le Pen, Frauke Petri and Geert Wilders, I feel very comfortable in attaching the term populist to him.
Well, sure, but it's simply that we shouldn't use it as this catch-all term for almost everybody now in Europe who simply thinks the other way on the matter of Brussels. There are people, but I don't deny, there are people on whom the term can be legitimately applied. But it has become something rather like Cambridge Analytica and Trump and a whole set of other things that's becoming politically useless.
I think that's the half point that I agree with.
Well, we'll work on the other half another time.
Okay. Now, I'm going to refrain from using the P word for the rest of this podcast as the neutral chair. But if we look to what's happened to the League and opinion polls since the collapse of the government, we are seeing the popularity of these parties actually rise. And the EU aren't doing anything to stop democratic elections. So is there anything they can really do in the long term, Douglas, if people keep voting like this? Surely these governments will have a proper run of it as time goes on.
Well, I just think we're in a period of profound stasis on this matter. I mean, just take two bits of the proposed coalition agreement that was going to happen if this government had come about in Italy. One was basically a form of universal basic income, obviously proposed by Five Star. Another was the swift deportation of 500,000 illegal migrants from Italy. Now, let me just take the second of those things. How likely do you think it is that if this government had been formed, that in the coming months the Italian government could have in an orderly manner arranged the deportation of 500,000 illegal migrants who certainly have no right to be in Italy? Very, very unlikely. So what happens with all of these things is you play into what the Italian public, I think, know very well, which is a deeper and deeper level of cynicism in all of the political class. Five Star is a prime example of this. Themselves a demonstration and an expression of profound political discontent, which then becomes political discontent squared, where not even Five Star are able to express the discontent of the Italian people.
Thanks, Douglas. Thanks, Tom.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellarplan.
Now, if the Eurosceptic Coalition Italy wins again in another election, Brussels may have to deal with rebellion from an EU founding state, which could cause another Eurozone crisis. What would this mean for us in Britain? Would it help or hinder Brexit? Even the Brexiteers are split on this question. But James Forsyth puts his money on it helping Brexit, and he explains his reasons in this week's issue. He joins me now, together with Nigel Farage, former leader of UKIP. So James, why do you think a Eurozone crisis would help Brexit?
I mean, there are three reasons to think that a Eurozone crisis would help the UK's negotiating position. The first is it would increase the EU's interest in an orderly Brexit with minimal economic disruption, because the Eurozone economy will be less able to cope with any shocks if there is a Eurozone crisis going on. The second reason I get strengthens the UK's negotiating position is it makes the UK's divorce payment more important. What a Eurozone crisis would do in crude terms is exacerbate the tensions in Europe over money between North and South. You've already seen the German budget commissioner basically saying the Italians are going to find out they can't do this because they can't afford to, brutally. If you read the German tabloids at the weekend, the way they talk about the Italians in Italy, would you know, people talk about our tabloids, but we get you in massive trouble here. And you see all those tensions between North and South would mean that no one would want to go back and have to either. No Dutch Prime Minister, for example, would want to have to go to his people and say, we actually now need to pay more into the EU budget because Britain's leaving. And no one in Southern Europe wants to say, we're going to get fewer projects benefiting us because there's less cash about. And then I think the third and perhaps most important thing is this, is I think a Eurozone crisis would probably change the EU's attitude towards the City of London and financial services. At the moment, the EU is taking a very hard line on this. But the London is, ironically, the de facto financial and banking capital of the Eurozone. It would be a very brave move in the middle of a Eurozone crisis for the EU to choose to unplug itself from its banking and financial capital.
But Nigel, we do know also that the European Union is a political project. And doesn't turmoil in the Eurozone just mean that those in Brussels will be even more keen to protect and prove leaving as a bad idea?
There are two Europes. You know, one is Brussels and the other are the member states and their governments. And they are two very different things. And I do agree, actually, with James's analysis, particularly on the City of London. I think if, you know, this downturn that may come as a result of the Italian crisis leads to an illiquidity crisis in the banking sector, then effectively the City of London is almost the lender of the last resort. So there will be absolutely demand from banks onto their central governments. For goodness sake, don't cast the City of London off. Clearly, already there are German car manufacturers and French wine producers, you know, who want a free trade deal and are worried. But the question is, how will Brussels react to a Eurozone crisis? And my view of these people, the commissioners, Juncker and the others, is the deeper the crisis, the worse their behaviour will be. So the only way that a serious Eurozone crisis helps Brexit is if the Macrons and the Merkels say to the Commission, right, this is what's going to happen. So I see that battle going on. And I felt, you know, it's very interesting, right from day one, I felt the whole British position on the renegotiation was wrong. We focused from the start on Brussels. We focused on civil servants talking to civil servants. And I always felt, right from the beginning, what we should have had was a roadshow, a UK-British business roadshow, going out round Europe, encouraging political movements encouraging businesses to pressurise their governments, to pressurise the Commission. And I'm afraid we've done precious little of that.
James, do you think the UK government underestimated how ideologically the Commission would be in these negotiations?
I think the rigidity of a Commission shouldn't have come as any surprise, in that you saw just how rigid they were during David Cameron's renegotiation. I mean, I think one of the things that enabled the Leave side to win the referendum was how relatively little Cameron came back with in that renegotiation. It made it very easy for people like Nigel to say in those referendum debates, look, you know, this is all they've offered us now. It's not going to get any better than this. And this is the best that they can offer. Is that good enough for you? And most people thought it wasn't. And so I think that the rigidity of the Commission should not have come as a surprise. I think the danger for the Commission is when they overreach. And that's when I think the member states haul them back in. I think you could roughly sum up the instructions from the member states to the Commission as squeeze the Brits as hard as you can, but without collapsing the talks. Whenever the talks look like being in danger of being collapsed, then I think the member states are more prepared to step in. I mean, that's one of the reasons why.
Doesn't that make our own position pathetically weak?
That's what I say. It's one of the problems with the lack of no-deal preparation, is it's quite obvious that we've got no intention of walking away from the table.
Nigel, you might have just answered my next question, but how do you think the government has handled the negotiations so far?
Abject. I mean, it's just awful, the whole thing. I mean, look, anybody that's worked in the real world knows that in any negotiation, you're renegotiating a contract, you're renegotiating a client relationship, whatever it is. You know, the only way any of this works is if you're concerned that the other person might walk out of the room. You know, that's what's got you there. That's what's got you worried. And it's been, I mean, I know she did come up with no deal is better than a bad deal, which I think I might have coined that phrase in the referendum. I can't remember now.
Copyright.
But it doesn't matter. But you know, she has said that a couple of times. And, you know, we occasionally get the big Lancaster House speech and she says all the right things. But they've known from the beginning there's absolutely no intention of us walking away. And I think, so we've started off in a very weak position. I think we've been completely outclassed, frankly, by Barnier. And I think over the Irish border, one or two issues like that. I mean, she's almost got herself into checkmate.
James, other than wait and perhaps hope for a Eurozone crisis, what can the government do to get these negotiations back on track?
Well, I think one of the kind of crucial things, I mean, so you all risk a bit starting like, well, I wouldn't have started from here. I think one problem is that you obviously, the lack of no-deal preparations weakens your hand because people are less inclined to think you're going to step away from the table. I think one thing you could do is start pointing out to the Irish that actually, yes, obviously Northern Ireland is important to them in political terms, but in economic terms, that east-west border is a much bigger deal for the Irish Republic than the north-south border. And start working with them saying, look, come on, let's find a way to make some of these things work and let's take on some of the people in the Commission who are less interested in some of these things. I think the other thing that the UK should be doing much, much more of is reminding people that the UK is responsible for a disproportionate amount of Europe's defence, and it spends that money and it is prepared to commit those troops and planes and ships because it believes in the European alliance, it believes in friendly relations with its neighbour states, and basically stress, let's not fall out to such an extent in these negotiations that when UKIP Mark II or whatever party it is comes back, one of its policies is let's get all those soldiers home from Poland and the Baltic Republics. You know, I think that one of the things that Barnier is in danger of doing is creating a domestic political pressure here for Britain to kind of almost withdraw from Europe in a geostrategic sense, as well as from the European Union as a political project.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Their behaviour, you know, towards us over a variety of issues, you know, over GPS style systems, etc., you know, Galileo, etc. Yeah. I mean, my feeling is actually the fanaticism that is there in Brussels now for a European army, air force, and navy to be completed by 2025, allied to a foreign policy that continues to be expansionist to the east. And Mr. Juncker couldn't have made it clearer, you know, in his big annual speech, where they will remove veto from member states. I actually now think there are many in Brussels that want America and Britain out of Europe completely, and they believe they can do this on their own. Now, I think they're very, very foolish, but I don't think that card actually is very effective anymore.
I think it is effective for the member states, though.
Again, we're back to that debate, aren't we? Is it Brussels or is it?
Yeah. Member states are either worried about their own security, in the sense of those countries which border Russia.
But they're not paying 2%, are they? And this is really interesting.
Poland are, Estonia are. Well,
I think 3 out of 28.
Poland, Estonia and Greece. But it's no surprise that Poland and Estonia are two of the kind of countries on the front line. And then I also think that on that point, you know, do the other countries in Europe really want to start having to massively increase their defence spending in the way that they would if, as Nigel suggests, you go down this route? They have been convinced.
I've been watching this very carefully. Barnier, Juncker in particular, and yesterday, you know, I was sitting next to Oettinger yesterday, basically saying that for the next seven-year programme, what they're going to do, and they are worried about the Brexit hole, there's no question about that, but what they're going to do, they're going to cut spending on agriculture, they're going to cut spending on cohesion and hugely increase spending on defence. And Oettinger repeated it yesterday. Oh, there's no need for anybody in Europe to spend 2% on defence. You can spend 1% with us. And because of economies of scale, you know, you will get the same result. And I genuinely think, in terms of geopolitics, the Commission wants NATO out of Europe. And I think it's incredibly foolish.
I think it is interesting, though, when you look at Emmanuel Macron's talk about a European intervention force, he it seems, is going to set this up outside of EU structures, which is surely a kind of blow massive, you know, to what you're saying. But this is the fact that Macron, you know, regarded as the, you know, one of the most pro-EU politicians around out there, when he's thinking about security policy, he's thinking outside of EU structures, I think is very significant. It does show you how much resistance there would be to the idea of basically the Commission running a Europe-wide foreign policy.
Nigel, where do you think the Britain will be in the Brexit negotiations in 3 years' time?
Well, I'm more worried about what's going to happen on the 28th of June, to be honest with you, because I think whatever we say about Ireland, Barnier is going to say no. I mean, I think agreeing to the backstop, as we did in December, now leaves us. I said earlier, we're almost in checkmate. You know, I think she comes home on the 29th of June from that summit, probably having to say to her own party and Brexit voters, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to go for full regulatory alignment. I think we're in a very bad place.
So do you think that we're going to get into a position where it is the new phrase, you know, leaving in name only, Brexit?
Absolutely. But it could even be more serious than that. I mean, when you have a total lack of leadership, and that's what we've had, as I say, three speeches where it all sounds good, and then concession, concession, concession. An endless, isn't it funny? We spent 25 years trying to opt out of things in the EU. Now we're trying to opt back into virtually everything we possibly can. And I think in that, with that genuine lack of leadership, not carrying the country with her, I'm obviously pretty concerned as to what's going to happen in the House of Commons over the customs union vote. I don't know what James thinks, whether she's going to win that vote or not. But I think we're heading for... I think, as far as Brexit's concerned, we may well be heading for a pretty big crisis over the next few months.
Thanks, James and Nigel. Across the pond, things aren't going much smoother. Robert Mueller's special investigation into Trump's potential collusion with Russia doesn't seem to have had much success. Byron York, from the Washington Examiner, writes in this week's magazine that Mueller isn't closing in on Trump, and the Democrats are twisting over backwards to get impeachment. Has the investigation really been so lacklustre? I'm joined by Freddie Gray, editor of Spectator USA, and David Priest, author and former CIA officer who worked with Mueller. Freddie, is it fair to say that this investigation hasn't gone as well as the Democrats had hoped?
Well, I mean, it hasn't finished yet, so there's no way to really say what it will achieve or anything like that. So I don't think we should jump the gun. But I think what Byron's piece is saying is undoubtedly true, that the initial idea of the investigation, that it was going to prove some very sophisticated collusion between the Trump campaign and Putin, directly almost, was the sort of implication that was often made, it just hasn't really panned out, and I don't think it's going to. And another point that he makes, which is very good, is that Rudy Giuliani, who's Donald Trump's now part of Donald Trump's legal team, has actually been very effective in taking the attack to the Mueller investigation. I think it's cynical and it's unfair, and he's almost admitted, in fact, he has admitted that it's just cynical. But the point is, it's working. And the Democrats, having invested so much of their strategy to defeat Trump on this investigation and on the possibility of impeachment, are now in big trouble.
David, you worked with Mueller. Do you agree that this investigation has so far been lackluster?
We're talking about two different things here. That is, two different fields of play. One field of play is the investigation itself, and that's all of the interviews, all of the financial records, all of the plea deals that are getting more cooperation.
And that's all operating in silence because Robert Mueller is the tightest ship in the business. The quietest person in Washington, D.C. these days is the spokesperson for this investigation. That is all happening inside very quiet hallways and meeting rooms. Then there is the public discussion of what's going on, which is informed slightly by reporting that has come out, largely, it appears, from witnesses who have gone before the grand jury and given testimony, talking about the kinds of questions they got and the things they said, and then by the indictments that have dropped. Now, I will say that this being portrayed as a Trump versus Mueller showdown is a bit false because you've got Mueller working on his job, doing the job that he was directed to do as special counsel. And he has chosen not to play the game of PR. He has chosen not to go out and put a spokesman out there to counter Rudy Giuliani on the talk shows. He's conceding that, saying, I will let my work speak for me. So in a sense, we've got two different levels going here. Now, there is a bigger issue, which I'm sure we'll discuss about whether one of those impacts the other. But for now, I think it says very little about the Mueller investigation itself, simply because of what Rudy Giuliani and others are making of it in a PR sense.
I think that's certainly true to say that Mueller has not indulged in PR. And in fact, I think he's great proof of the fact that if you want the best PR, don't do PR. He hasn't said anything publicly. He's the tightest ship. He hasn't leaked at all. And, you know, it seems to be working. You hear nothing apart from what a good guy, what a straight shooter he is. And I don't dispute that at all. But I think what this piece is trying to do, what Byron York's piece is saying, and I think he's got a very good point, is if you get away from the investigation itself and look at the politics of the investigation, and it should be remembered this investigation was started because of politics, then the Democrats are losing on the political front because they
Freddie, I think you have a good point there, which is that there is a political battle going on, and Rudy Giuliani named it, and it's identified in the article. He's speaking to a jury of the American people thinking, if this comes to impeachment, representatives and then senators, if there is an impeachment and it goes to a removal vote, that they will be representing to some degree the views of their constituents. That is definitely a valid point. However, we have to keep in mind that in order to preserve his credibility for coming out with indictments for whatever does come of this at the end, Mueller can't be out there doing what essentially Ken Starr did back in the hearings for Bill Clinton in the Whitewater investigation, when he was publicly engaging and members of his staff were talking to reporters. It undermined his credibility when the charges eventually came out. So I think there's that level going on as well.
Freddie, on the subject of PR, Byron York makes the point that Giuliani has been very effective at discrediting Mueller through constant attacks in public. But this is also the same Giuliani who pretty much on his first day of work said Trump did pay Stormy Daniels, the porn star, to be quiet about their affair. So is he really that good?
Well, I sort of bought the argument very early on, when it was certainly after that Hannity interview where he made this massive gaffe over Stormy Daniels, that Giuliani's not all there. He doesn't seem to be very compos mentis, and he's a sort of crazy man on TV. I remember seeing his convention speech in Cleveland in 2016, and it was barking mad. So I thought that he sort of lost it, but it has to be conceded that in a sort of strategic sense, going after Mueller makes sense. It may not be fair, because I don't think Mueller is on a witch hunt himself, but I think the Trump team have taken the view that this investigation, if allowed to roam freely throughout the administration, is going to take Trump down, and they have to discredit it, they have to destroy it. And it looks as though that's been effective, and it's been particularly effective in the run-up to the midterms, because the Republicans want the midterms to become an impeachment on Trump vote, because Trump is more popular in a way than the party is. And so therefore, if they can make the midterm elections about an up or down vote on Trump, that's a successful strategy for him.
And David, touching on the prospect of impeachment or the prospect not of it, do you think the Democrats are making a mistake to focus too much on impeachment?
Yeah, I've seen the polling numbers that the people self-identifying as Democrats in the United States are eager to see impeachment. And so they're certainly pushing that out there for the people who are going to be going into the midterms. But I am not seeing a groundswell of support from that among the representatives themselves. That is, I don't see that much reaction coming from it. The primary campaign issues, as they're starting to emerge, and it's still early now, do not appear to be impeachment. It appears to be other issues of policy and perhaps issues of the character of the president. But I'm going to be surprised if we see a majority of representatives running this fall on a platform that is led by impeachment. Now, there may be issues that relate to impeachment that come up in those conversations. We also have to remember it's early. It's well before the election. And I think Byron makes a point in the article itself about the fact that, well, the economy seems to be doing well. There have been some foreign policy successes, or at least an avoidance of failures. But there's also some down news, and it's 6 months away from the election. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down, I think, 6.5% since January. Gas prices in the United States are climbing more rapidly than they have in years. And we just got the first quarter economic numbers. And in fact, economic growth has slowed to a 2.2% annual rate, well below the 3% rate that the Trump administration had lowered their goal to from the original 4% that they had put out there coming into office. That happening over the summer could start to change some of those numbers, because we have seen the economic data linked more closely to popularity figures and performance numbers than just about anything else in American political polling.
I think that's almost certainly true, David. I think that from what I'm hearing from Republicans, they're perhaps being a bit hubristic about the state of the economy and the state of their chances in the midterms. But I do wonder whether the point is valid that the Democrats have excited their base so much with this idea of Trump as this criminal monster that they have to bring down, that they can't really do anything other than run as a series of anti-Trump campaigns.
You know, you have Freddie, you're exactly right, is they have to campaign against Trump or else their base will be disappointed. Whether they campaign actively on specific charges of impeachment, I don't think they have valid articles of impeachment yet. We've talked about issues in the United States like the Emoluments Clause, and the fact is the president benefiting privately from his public office. That's out there. Mm. But all of the things related to the special counsel's investigation, which may touch on possible cooperation with Russia, it may touch on money laundering in the campaign or in related areas, none of that is there yet, and all of those could feed into articles of impeachment on obstruction of justice, getting to issues of high crimes and misdemeanors as laid out in the Constitution, as well as bribery laid out in the Constitution. None of that is there yet. So campaigning on a specific impeachment article is not going to happen until or unless the Robert Mueller investigation produces some of that information.
I think I agree with that, David. Pat Buchanan put it well last year when he said that the Mueller investigation has Trump in a kill box, because to a certain extent, the collusion element of it doesn't really matter. When you have a person like Trump who has a worldwide business that undoubtedly has done shady things, and there are undoubtedly shady elements and characters connected to Trump, there is no way in which a wide-ranging investigation can't attach something extremely damaging to him. And I think that's why the Trump campaign have been so aggressive recently in trying to shut the investigation down or to defeat it politically.
And the special counsel's mandate, we have to remember, was to investigate Russian activities in the election and related matters. And those related matters have included a number of things that we've seen. And it's remarkable, really, that this investigation is only 1 year in. And 1 year seems like a long time, and the attention span of the American people is remarkably short. But in 1 year, there have been 19 people indicted, 3 companies indicted, 5 plea deals. There's one person in prison already. When we compare this to previous investigations that were frankly less complex and less international than this one, the Watergate investigation went for, I think, 4 years. The Iran-Contra investigation for Ronald Reagan's time went longer than 6 years. The Whitewater probe for Bill Clinton went on for 7 years. And now this probe, a year in, has much more to show for it than any of those. That doesn't necessarily help with people looking for information right now in the 24/7 cycle we're in But it does show you there is progress being made. And with the plea deals that have come in, it would be surprising to me if there is not more information that is more directly related to the Russian ties than we have seen before.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Freddie. And if you want to find out more about the Spectator's take on US politics, why not listen to the Americano podcast, where Freddie talks all things America with special guests. And that's all for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe, rate and review on the iTunes store. We'd love to hear from you. And also, do make sure to pick up this week's issue to read all the pieces discussed in the podcast, as well as more from Michael Mupago, Rachel Johnson and Damian Thompson. And we also have a special offer for podcast listeners. Simply go to spectator.co.uk/podoffer to pick up 12 issues of The Spectator for only £12, as well as a limited edition Moleskine notebook. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.